So before I formally introduce Claude Marx, who's here to talk about some of the issues in the film, and I think draw the connections to why the film is relevant today, I did want to thank The Red Vic, because this is a film that's 15 years old about issues that, although they're ongoing, are part of the past. And I think it's pretty incredible to be able to watch a film like this on a screen in front of a group of people. I've only ever seen this film on YouTube in like stolen parts 1, 2, 3 through 10 or whatever. So to watch it in its entirety with a group of people and to be able to talk about issues afterwards is awesome. And it's only because of places like this that you can do that. And they were so generous in letting us pick the films to play today that I wanted to thank them and thank you all for coming out to support them. So, and also, just I wanted to say that it was really incredible watching this film in the wake of both inspiring to think about what we can accomplish if we organize, and disturbing in what happened to the Black Panther Party, but also in the wake of the revolution that's been going on in Egypt. I think it's just interesting to think about this film in that context. But anyways, we can talk about that in the hall. This is Claude Marx, one of the directors of the Freedom Archives, and also a filmmaker behind the film COINTELPRO 101, which is not available yet. But soon, so we're very excited about that. And also a former political prisoner.
Right. We could open up with questions, but maybe I can just say something that strikes me every time I see this film. Of course, Mamiya, who's in it, and Leonard Peltier, who's in it, are more well known and are both still locked up some 15 years after being in this film. Mutulu Shakur, not only is he locked up, as is H. Rapp Brown or Jamil Al-Amin, they're in the heaviest duty prison in the United States, which is ADX Florence, a control unit prison, which has a purpose of essentially isolating people physically and psychologically until they're destroyed. Everybody that I know there, including Mutulu and Jamil Al-Amin, are resistant, and so they're in fact not destroyed by the experience. But the argument that is addressed at the end, including, you know, the prophetic words of Yuri Kochiyama, who fortunately is still with us, is that, you know, this is what this country does to people who resist. And we certainly see that today in terms of the kinds of newer prosecutions that are going on, whether it be the animal rights or environmental folks that are getting outrageous sentences, people like Marie Mason, who got 20 plus years for a property crime, which this government has now defined as an act of terrorism, simply to try to destroy the potential of a movement like that from taking root and becoming more massive, to the grand juries that we're seeing now in the Midwest that are essentially telling us that if you support struggles outside this country, and the ones in Chicago are largely focused on support for Palestine, and to some extent as well the struggle in Colombia, and so if you're an activist doing that kind of work, you then can be targeted for giving material aid to what they've deemed to be terrorist struggles. But simply by the definition that this government gives to terrorist groups or terrorist struggles is not really the only way to look at it. And, you know, certainly in the case of Palestine, what myself and a lot of people consider to be a legitimate struggle for a nation, for an identity, despite a lot of challenges and the settler colonialism of Israel, the fact that one can support that and be deemed a terrorist simply for having those ideas is pretty problematic. And what it's emblematic of is a pretty consistent way in which the government, our government, chooses to criminalize dissent and to try to antagonize people who are willing to think in a different way about the world. The people who you see in Li Luli's film are people who are very committed to trying to transform the world into something much more humane. And that brings them into conflict. It brings them into conflict with the state. And the state clearly has more power. we're seeing ways that mass movements can overcome those kinds of hurdles. I think Casey's reference to Egypt is a good one. And, you know, there's a whole transformative part of that. We'll see where it goes, but it's clearly a very liberating experience for masses of people to say, look, we've had enough of a level of dictatorship and fascism. We're challenged with the same thing, but we have a much more Herculean task to try to bring that number of people out. And yet, we can aspire to do it. And certainly for myself, as I age, I have a tremendous faith in other generations that will follow to take up the mantle of a struggle, which in my case landed me in prison as well. I don't regret it. And I don't think that everyone should have to experience it, but I think it's part of the reality of wanting a world based on a different set of values. So having said that, I'm sure this film evokes a lot of things for people. Maybe we can open it up a little bit. And the other thing, before we get too carried away, is I really want people to stick around for the next film, because I think it's important to see how issues are connected, and generations apart, the level of repression that our movements face are very similar. The Panthers were called, you know, the largest threat to the stability of the United States, which this film makes clear, as the other movements as well that are represented. I think there's some truth to that, because in that era, there was a real threat to the stability of the United States, and it wasn't a bad thing. Now the term gets used in terms of the kind of anti-terrorism laws being applied to other movements, animal liberation and environmentalism. One can only hope that those movements live up to the potential that they have in really transforming and saving the planet and reaching out to create a more humanitarian reality for everybody on it. So having said that, stick around, but let's open it up. Anybody? In the back.
Do you see any hope for the political prisoners that are in the film that, you know, as you mentioned, are still incarcerated for life sentences? Is there any hope to get them out, and what's the main impediment? Because there's movements obviously trying to get them out, and people working for that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a good question. I'm hopeful that something can get done to apply more pressure. I don't think it's a legal struggle that's going to attain it. I think it has to be a mobilized consciousness among masses of people that, you know, that is willing to unmask the basis for which they're in there. We're talking about some of these people have been locked up for 45 years. I mean, that's ridiculous. There's been some success around the Puerto Rican political prisoners, because that nation and the island of Puerto Rico, irrespective of what political differences might exist there, have united around the question of getting their prisoners out. There's a current struggle, I mean current like today, struggle around Oscar Lopez Rivera, who's one of the last remaining prisoners from the early 1980s, who's up for parole, and his parole hearing consisted of a mock trial put on by the U.S. government for something he wasn't even charged for, with victims coming in for an event that he was unconnected to in order to keep him in. There's been international movements, but there has to be more, clearly. Mamiya's life is on the line. And in some cases, the struggles to try to get people out, even on a compassionate basis, have utterly failed. You know, some of the people who you saw on the poster at the end no longer are alive. And the list of people who were martyred that came up with the credits, unfortunately, is even longer at this point. So I'm hopeful because I'm willing to do that work. It's proven to be very difficult because people with the power to really change the situation aren't feeling enough pressure to do the right thing. And legally, you know, the laws have become more draconian post 9/11 with the Patriot Act and stuff. The kind of, in our film, we talk about the history of COINTELPRO, and what was egregious in the 70s and investigated by Congress is totally legitimate in a period like this. And you can see that with, you know, the unfortunate loss of Egypt, one of the main places that people are renditioned to for torture and disappearance. But, you know, let's hope we can see, you know, that change have some impact within this country as well, is all I can say.
Will COINTELPRO 101 be playing anytime soon again in the Bay Area?
It's going to be showing as part of a hip-hop film festival next Friday night at 2111 Mission Street at 9. That's a small venue. I've actually been talking to folks here at the Red Vic to see if we can bring it in.
Yeah, it's called Twin Space.
Twin Space, thank you.
Yeah, it's called Twin Space.
So that's next Friday. We're going to be at San Francisco State March 3rd. At 10 a.m. at the Student Union. It's part of a program being put on by Project Rebound there. And, you know, there'll be other opportunities. I'm hoping we'll be in the Elmwood Theater in the East Bay at some point.
Can you talk a little bit about why you were a political prisoner, how that happened and what that was about, and then also what the Freedom Archives are?
Sure. I was part of basically clandestine work in the United States in the 80s and 90s, and part of what we did was we fought in solidarity with some of the movements in this, the Puerto Rican independence movement, the Black Liberation Struggle, and Native Americans. And in the course of that, I was part of a conspiracy to try to break Oscar Lopez Rivera out of Leavenworth that essentially was infiltrated by the FBI. And so it didn't succeed, unfortunately. And that ended up with a whole lot of drama. And I wasn't captured right away. And our group was able to maintain itself for a pretty significant amount of time until we decided that our usefulness as activists would be far better served by a couple of us doing prison time and being able to bring our collective back into a level of public organizing. So that's the very short version of my case. The Freedom Archives is a radical collection of media, both politics and culture, that goes back many years, and we try to figure out ways of ourselves repurposing the history, but also making it available for other people to repurpose as a way to build and maintain roots with the kinds of struggles that precede what we're involved in today. And we're at freedomarchives.org. So check us out.
Two things. A question and then a comment. First, a question. Regarding the film we just saw, does the Freedom Archives happen to have any copies of Power to the People? If so, which formats?
We have a copy that we've gotten from the producer for reuse with permission for the documentary that we just completed. We sampled a couple things out of it with Lila Lee's cooperation. I think it's very hard to come by the film in a legitimate way. We have no rights to distribute it. So out of respect for him, we don't. I wish he were to come out with it in the form of a DVD or something so that it's not just up on YouTube, which is a rough way to have an impact.
Gordon, we'll take it. And when you were speaking earlier, you used the words, our government. I would use the if I were giving a speech in a public domain, such as a volunteer-run movie theater like this, for example, I would not use the words "our government." I would use the words "this land's government" instead.
Point well taken.
This government was never mine to begin with.
Right. Well, I would agree. It's a, you know, a figure of speech that one lapses into. I certainly agree with you. You know, it's a settler colonial government in a lot of ways, is what I would say if I were to think about it more clearly.
Based maybe on your own experience, but also others' experiences, are there any hard lessons learned that you can boil down in a brief conversation like this about security culture, what people call security culture, and how to be more effective and yet be overt and be open? You want to be among people, you want to be able to bring people into a movement, and yet any liberatory movement is constantly on the edge, being pushed over that edge by repressive forces of the nation state.
Well, let me preface an answer by saying that there's 2.5 million people locked up in this country. The vast majority are not white. And it's not entirely because of someone's conscious politics that there's that many people locked up. So the issue of our security, if you will, is a much more comprehensive kind of, we have to look at it much more comprehensively than just, you know, if we're involved in politics, how do we make sure our group isn't infiltrated? For which there is no easy answer. On one hand, you know, you want to be open and be organizing and be creating relationships with people. And on the other hand, you know, you've got a state that is willing to fabricate anything to take people out or assassinate them, or what, you know, the issue of gathering of information, certainly with their ability to employ technology, is huge. There's no way to game it. And it's sort of tied in with the question of, you know, what does mass work look like? Are there risks if you're doing mass work? Of course, people get set up anyway, whether they're up to something or not. You know, I mean, I don't have an easy answer. I think the faith that I have is that if in doing political work, we can have real relationships among people and challenge behavior and issues that are problematic and disuniting within a movement, that I hope we can get smarter about how we do some stuff. But there's no guarantee even doing that. And there's no such thing as risk-free organizing anyway, because it's a very fluid situation, and if they decide that certain work has potential, they're going to move. I think that's what's happening in Chicago with this grand jury. I don't know if people are familiar with it. I referenced it. But basically, they're taking activists and saying, you'll either cooperate with the agents at your door, or we're going to take your shit and take you to court and put you in jail for not cooperating. That's how the grand jury functions. If we really are serious, that's part of the risk. And luckily, there's been unanimity among the 23 people subpoenaed to a grand jury in Chicago to say that we refuse to even appear. And that clearly is the best way to fight it. But there's no way to fight it that is a guarantee that you're never going to do any jail time or prison, even more seriously. So, I don't know, that's a whole lot of conversation could try to ask and approach your question, so, yeah.
Along the same line, I'm a person who believes there needs to be a massive movement, you know, against the status quo and the established system. But, and that's, you know, with the people, power to the people, like the hat, and the movie. But what's the best way to gain credibility in the eyes of the public? Like, there's all this talk of conspiracy theories and, you know, people going against, especially with terrorism being such a popularized threat. And the media is so powerful. It's a brainwashing machine controlled by even more powerful corporations with ties to the government. So how can we get past that? Like, I mean, it's open to anyone, and I'm trying to find solutions, too.
But, well, I mean, I think getting together like this is a part of it, right?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people who are would express their skepticism at what's being thrown at them by the mass media and the popular culture. Then the problem is you know, how do you start to mobilize that into something different? And there's a lot of work involved. And you know, certainly if we can start to create some ways of doing that on a more local level, it can spread. I don't think it can be a very top-down process. You know, we can't compete with type of corporate influence, and even the technology that's being put in front of us can be used as a tool, but isn't really an answer. I mean, it's not a substitute for real human contact. And to me, that's one of the downsides to, you know, the technology and electronic communication. I mean, I grew up organizing in the community, which is a very different kind of thing than putting an email out and expecting, you know, hundreds of people to show up somewhere.
Yeah.
Even though that can work to mobilize around something that people are already conscious about. So I'm not putting it down, but Michelle?
Just like a comment to go with that is that I think one of the best lessons for me personally of the Panthers is the free breakfast programs, and is really looking at what people's needs are and addressing that in a way. I mean, I don't think you can find a better way to get credibility than, you know, providing services that the state is not providing, and providing them, you know, in a way that's empowering for people. So you look at free clinics, you work with free breakfast. I mean, I think that's one of the most important legacies we have from that era.
Although, you know, that was done at the same time as monitoring the day-to-day function of the police in the community. So it wasn't in isolation. It was part of a very integrated view of what serving the community is about. And I think both parts of it were very real and very impactful and attracted a huge amount of community engagement and spread the party in a way that was faster than they could even fathom themselves. I know that from talking to a lot of folks. You know, and the questions remain. That's, you know, that question and that conversation is one that I maintain with people who are now in their 36th and 38th year inside, who are members of the party, the Black Panther Party. You know, they're still trying to wrap their minds around what your question is, and, you know, how do we overcome the weaknesses in a period when COINTELPRO has taken out the leaders and the leading organizations, and when mass imprisonment functions as a chief form of social control, when gang injunctions are about targeting people in our community, particularly the youth, when people are assassinated by the cops, when there's no accountability to the police and how they function, all that stuff. I'm not an expert, so if someone has a comment, that's great. Feel free. Uh-huh.
Well, you know, I think each country is different there as far as how to have a successful revolution, but I've just learned a lot from monitoring this Egyptian thing, just really studying everything I could on it, you know, what was going on day by day as it was unfolding. And they had a different situation over there than we have, in the sense that, from what I know, most people over there were just poorer than we are, and more desperate, and not as much to lose. I understand that people like lawyers over there, not lawyers so much, but I heard like nurses and some of the professional people just hardly made it very much money either. And that grew over several years. It built up Egypt with a lot of the unions and the sweatshop workers and the women and stuff having strikes, and it was kind of built up. But I've learned a lot just from Egypt, even though you can't directly apply it over here. But again, they didn't have leaders to be assassinated. It's a grassroots movement that, you know, was not any political leader or any religious thing or anything like that. And even though they had a lot of people trying to infiltrate them and break them up and media that was telling them a bunch of baloney, somehow the people so far have just overcome all that, you know, just working together. But I think that the co-op movement, I'm reading a book about the co-op movement that's very interesting, and this here is a co-op in the United States. And I think that is a revolutionary movement to have cooperatives and alternative businesses to the system that is. So there's a lot to talk about, but the people's food system that used to be in the Bay Area, and that I am trying to learn about how that got destroyed by the police, and it's, you know, there's a lot to it. But to make a long story short, they were tied in with the Black Panther Party too, somewhat. Some of that food that was going to the free breakfast program came from the people's food system and some of the co-ops in the Bay Area. And the Berkeley co-op was really incredible and very vast. And that went down, and they competed with Safeway for prices and low pricing and all that. So there's so much to think about and talk about, but I just try to study other revolutionary movements in history and study other things and what worked and what didn't, and try to learn part of it that way to try to figure out what to do now, you know?
Yeah.
I think...
I was going to ask something. Can I answer?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I was just going to reference something, but I...
No, you go first.
No, please.
I was going to say that to what you're saying about revolution is that I think that, you know, it becomes obvious when you have something to fight, and it's obvious what you're supposed to fight. And right now it seems like people need to be woken up to what that is.
Yeah.
So maybe you start off, and starting off locally is really important. It's what the Black Panthers did. And Bobby Seale says it in the movie, you know, capture the imagination of the people. I think that's a really important catchphrase to think about when you're organizing. And maybe when you think about the big picture of what the change is that you want to see, pick something really small that you can accomplish and do it really well and involve people and capture their imagination and then grow it out. So have like a plan, but start small. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
There, just apropos Egypt, this afternoon I watched a 25-minute piece that is, you can find on Al Jazeera, which is a background piece they did on the April 6th movement, which is one of the significant parts of bringing masses of people into the streets in Egypt. And that movement is actually 3 years old, and it was very interesting because those young people, and they were young, were trying to argue against the mythology that it's totally leaderless. They functioned collectively, but they've really been strategizing about how to mobilize for a long time. And part of their analysis told them that with what happened in Tunisia, this was a propitious moment to try to amp up. And they tell that story. So if you go to Al Jazeera English, and under programs, they have a whole body of videos. And one of them is the history. I mean, they got in and they worked with the April 6th folks for a chunk of time and produced this really interesting short piece about the dynamics that led to now the, you know, the absence of Mubarak. We'll see what happens, but it was very cool.
Yeah, Al Jazeera is the best news I've encountered. I've been on it pretty much since Egypt started, and this is the only time. But it's really a great resource. It's like english.aljazeera.net, I think.
Yeah,
it might not
I think that's
be
right.
That, but it's
right.
Something like that.
Easy to find, though, yeah.
I think really... I mean, that's a good idea about something small, doing it very well, like a thorough coverage that, you know, it can be a success. It might be small, but it'll start a dominoes. And it's just like the system is so established, but there are signs of it failing, like this whole economic crap, you know, it's been in the crap for a while. And maybe just making it fail faster and having, you know, the ideas in a lot of people's hearts and minds about what should happen after is a good way.
You know, there's a campaign in Los Angeles right now to make West Hollywood the first fur-free city in the country. And it's really interesting because they've chosen a very accomplishable task in a very friendly city. You know, there's council people there that are friendly to this initiative, and there's a group of activists in Los Angeles that, you know, for all the infiltrations we hear about vegan potlucks or whatever, they've really gone a long way to getting activists in Los Angeles organized.
Oh, yeah.
And now when there's a call to action, like come out for this initiative to make West Hollywood fur free, people come out by the hundreds. And they're doing it every Saturday now, and it's growing and growing because it's capturing the imagination. And I think that people feel if we can get West Hollywood, maybe we can get Los Angeles, maybe we can get Beverly Hills, maybe we can take this, you know, outside of California or whatever. So I think that's a good example. You should watch how that campaign goes. Hopefully it'll go well, but it'll be interesting to see how they grow it.
I was just going to say, you know, Arundhati Roy is an author from India, and she said it well. I think she said that you can't just go on demonstrations on one day a week and then go back to your normal way of life. She said, you really have to go whole hog and you have to take a risk and you have to, it's messy. You have to go to jail sometimes. You have to do all kinds of stuff sometimes. But it's worth it. It's worth the end result. It's worth going towards something that's fantastic. So it's worth all the risk. And all the risks are there. Anything could happen. Absolutely. You could be beaten to a pulp, but you know, mm-hmm. What if you were going towards freedom? Wouldn't that be worth a lot?
Hell yeah.
I mean, that's part of the, you know, we've been taught to expect a life, a pretty privileged life at the behest of how the world is getting ripped off for our stuff, right? And what we enjoy. If you want to destroy it, if you want to bring it down and reform it in some other way, that's not going to be a comfortable process. And life isn't going to get easier doing it for anybody. So as if this empire, U.S. imperialism, is actually in the beginnings of a stage of collapse, we can't expect to hang on to our iPads. Anybody else? How's our time? I can't tell what's happening.
I don't know what time is it.
6:30.
6:35.
Okay.
So the next film's at 7. I hope you stick around.
Yeah, and there's vegan cinnamon rolls. If you purchase a ticket for all 3 films, it's included. If not, it's only $5, and that money goes to the Red Vic, as well as any money you spend on popcorn, which is a good thing.
So support places like this. We need these, you know, collectives functioning in our community. We have several. We're blessed here. You have to support them all. It's the only... it's the only real thing if you're trying to create alternative communities. So, and it's more than entertainment. So, although it's entertainment too.
So, any other questions? Yeah.
Thank you.
So, I would also say to anybody, I'm going to put my little pitch in here since we have a few minutes. If you're not planning on staying to see The Spook Who Sat by the Door, I really encourage you to stay to see that film. It is an amazing piece of cinema that was made in 1973 based on a really great book. And, you know, United Artists, who paid for the film, thought they were getting this blaxploitation film that was really in and hot. And what they got was this really amazing piece of revolutionary cinema that was talking about ideas and what is revolution. And it ends with Chicago in flames, and it's awesome. So you should stay and see it. Okay. Thanks.
Thank
so
you.
Go get a cinnamon roll. And I know where you can get that film, by the way.